Kia ora, welcome to episode 30 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Seraphine Pick at her home and studio in Whanganui, Atara, Wellington. Seraphine has conducted a practice for over 30 years, in that time always exploring and evolving subject matter, use of materials, and her overall approach to painting. Her work is held in numerous public and private collections, including the Museum of New Zealand Te Papa Tongarewa, the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tamaki, the Christchurch Art Gallery Te Puna o Waifitu, and the Douse Art Museum. She has been the recipient of several awards and residencies, including the Rita Angus Artist Residency. Seraphine holds a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Islam School of Fine Arts at the University of Canterbury. She is represented by Michael Lett Gallery in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, and Station Gallery in both Nam, Melbourne and Gadigal, Sydney. There are images of the paintings that we talk about on the Good Oil Seraphine Pick Instagram post for your reference. In the episode, you'll hear Seraphine speak about a want to not know how to approach a new mode of making to keep her practice interesting, her recent collaborations with ceramicist Jamie Jenkins and how that is influencing her practice, the sound and silence of her paintings, a want to more and more make paintings into objects, and the need to see human vulnerability in paintings in the age of AI. We started by talking about growing up with the influence of her artist parents in Northland.
My first experiences of art were probably right from the beginning, right from the word go, because both my parents went to art school at Islam in Christchurch in the 60s.
Your dad was a potter, right?
Yeah, my dad was a potter.
And your mum?
And my mum was, well, she did painting for a while, and she's still painting now, but family life got in the way for her for a while. My dad still makes ceramics, so they're 80 and 84 now, so that's amazing, yeah. So, yeah, my father was an art teacher as well, so I had a lot of, and they had friends, art friends that came to visit, Tony Fomson, Dick Rizal. I remember them. I remember meeting artists, you know, that were practicing. And I even drew on one of Tony Fomson's monoprints. My father still got it. I was trying to spell my name. It was very long, Seraphine. So I was pulling lots of letters on that when I was, I don't know, I was about four.
So your hand still exists in a Tony Fomson work?
Yeah.
that's a great little side of New Zealand art history.
And my father twinked it out. all around it, because he was really embarrassed that I'd drawn all over it. But Tony apparently didn't mind at all. He thought it was really funny. But,
Oh, that's great.
So
really fully immersed from...
I was fully immersed. I don't remember any moment, but I do. I remember a moment of drawing because I grew up. My first few years, I might be getting this a little bit wrong. Well, I think we moved to Russell. My parents were at art school, got pregnant with me. My mother had to leave art school because she was pregnant, and she was 18. And then my father and her moved up to the Bay of Islands because he had to get a job and they had to get married in those days. And so he got a job teaching at Bay of Islands College, and that's how we ended up north. Then I'm not sure if he did that first or after, but we lived on Motorua Island for a few years. My parents were caretakers there. And I remember drawing on the beach. Like, I was an only child at the time. My brother hadn't been born. And I would draw figures, like a body in the middle and then the arms. I'd make them go all the way down one end of the beach and one down the other end of the beach. I remember drawing, because I had to spend a lot of time on my own, drawing on the beach and going up into the where all the trees had been planted, and apparently I had a lot of imaginary friends. I had a whole society out there, very detailed. My mother started to get a bit worried about me, so she got a dog. And eventually...
Good for the practice, though, surely. Yeah, yeah.
But so that was sort of my beginning, I think. It's made me, yeah, I don't know, I was just engaged with nature, I guess, straight off, because that was my environment. And we had people come out and visit, and kids would come out and stuff too. And my father would build cars on the beach that we would pretend to drive, things like that.
Great.
And I remember the ferries coming out with, they were called cream boats then, because they used to bring big cans of milk out and stuff. Oh, yeah. So
living quite
isolated
life. So it
was beautiful environment to be in, but it was probably quite isolating. So we moved into Russell and I started school there. So, yeah, that was my very beginning, yeah.
But I guess not with any art teachers that were going to compete with your parents.
Well, when I was at primary school, I remember Barbara Shortland, she was my teacher in form, I think I'm in standard two or something. Anyway, she was very encouraging. I remember the teachers, they were encouraging of my drawing. And then looking back, I realised that I was very deaf, so that wasn't picked up till I was 7 years old. So for all this time, I was missing out information, and sometimes they thought I was a bit naughty, so they put me at the back of the class and I would draw. So I was drawing as a way to deal with, I guess, all those sort of, probably quite traumatic, I imagine, but dealing with those sort of things. And I would do it through drawing. So that was good, getting that encouragement and, you know, getting your picture put up on the wall, that was encouragement.
Yeah, that's funny. I think I remember Judy Miller saying just the same. You get your picture put up.
My picture's put on the wall. Oh, what else are we doing, all right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I did have art all around me, so it was very normal. I didn't even think about being an artist. I just thought that was just what being was. Yeah. You know, it was just where you always... It's what you did with your time. You just, with the activities, that's what my parents give me, just chuck me paper and crayons, you know.
Or a beach.
You know, draw on.
Although that said, growing up in Northland, I've read that you were really impacted or really impressed by McCann's Northland panels as a work.
I was.
So did you see those quite young?
Yeah, I saw them probably... We went for a school trip. I was in high school probably when I first saw them, because I might have seen them before that, but I don't remember being conscious of it before that, but I would have seen them before that because my father would take me to art galleries in Auckland whenever we went there. We didn't go very often because both my parents couldn't drive, so we'd only get there if we got a lift or they'd hitch as well. That was the other thing.
Right, you'd be exposed to quite a lot of work.
Yeah, and so I saw the Northland panels probably on a high school trip with Selwyn Wilson was my art teacher. He was really good. I remember him, and he was just a really lovely man and very encouraging. And he took us to the art gallery and all that, and that's always very informative, encouraging stuff. Then it wasn't from my parents, so it was like another person's point of view of the art world, so it's always good. And he showed us lots of Maori art and all that. Also, my uncle is Cliff Whiting, and so so I always had that information into Maori art as well, and I grew up around in that kind of community too. So I did Maori at school till fifth form, but then I couldn't do any further because they wanted to just allow Māori kids to learn Māori because they only had one teacher then. So that was fine. But, I wished I'd kept learning, but I didn't. But, you know, I could still do it. It's not too late.
Yeah. I wonder if these had bled into the practice maybe at an early age as well. Seeing Gauguin works and Goya as well, I'd read you were exposed to, which are amazing works to be exposed to as a kid.
Well, I was exposed to a lot of art through my father. He had a big knowledge of art history, a big interest in art history. And he had some books, and in those days it wasn't like big glossy colour books. He had a lot of black and white books because when they were at art school, that's all they could get. And he's had a lot of his books from that time. He had a book on Goya. And he loved to show me all of Goya paintings, and the one The one that I most remember, which a lot of people would if they got shown it at like 4 or 5. You probably showed them to me earlier than that. But
it's a young age to be exposed to Goya paintings.
Horrible.
Yeah.
And it's the one of the devil eating the... It looks like a small person, a child, supposed to be a child, but it looks like a small scale human to me. Yeah, and it's a powerful painting, and yeah. It's it made me realise that, yeah, that images can be extremely powerful emotionally. So I kind of picked that up quite early, and it's like I could see that it could be used in that way, or to as a way of communication. Yeah,
that sounds like then, and I'm probably fast forwarding a little bit, but it sounds like then it was a pretty natural path for you to end up thinking, well, I want to go to art school, I want to formalize a practice.
Yeah, well, I got to the end of school, and I wasn't doing very well at school in my last year. It's mainly because there was turmoil at home. My parents broke up. So I was a little bit, not sure about what I wanted to do. I was a bit lost, actually. The only thing I did okay, what I passed my last year of school, was art. So my options were just limited. But I rejected it. Like, I was really rejecting it. Like, I didn't... Because my parents went to art school, so it was like...
You wanted to escape that.
I wanted to do something different. I don't want to be like them. Do something else.
Follow accountancy.
So
or...
I'm not quite that bad. No, I decided to go to apply for... fashion design. Of all things. Because I was sewing for a job, and I like sewing, and so I thought, oh, go and do that. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking. I don't really have a fashion head at all. I actually applied to go to art school at Elam, and I didn't get in. So that kind of went, I can't be good enough to get to art school.
Yeah, that's a burn.
Oh, well, I'll go to Polytech and I'll apply for that. And I also applied for art school down in... It was my father that was telling me to apply for art school. He goes, okay, but I'm going to apply for this other thing too. Yeah, so I did. So I had to come down here and have an interview at the Wellington Polytechnic, it was then. And I can't remember who interviewed me, but it was a woman, and she... saw the drawings I'd done the year before. I had a gap year, I guess you'd call it now, an enforced one, where I went to live in Auckland with my foster sister. I went and did drawing classes and stuff at the Auckland Art Society. And I did some life modelling as well for money, for the artists and the Mount Eden group. They were like Sylvia Saddell and Jacqueline Fahey and Terry Stringer. There was a group of artists that, and I came and modelled for them. So they probably got drawings and be naked.
Not bad teachers to have either, or not teachers, but... Not
yeah, well, that was interesting because I just listened to the conversations and it was fascinating. So it gave me a little bit of, just an listening into the stories of people from that time as well.
And I suppose in a way you would have had, you would have understood their vocabulary having grown up with
artists. I understood what they were, when they talked about colours and all that sort of thing. And I just remember them being really, really, really lively conversations. Yeah, which was Jackie there.
I bet.
She was amazing. Yeah.
It sounds like time with them then probably helps. I don't know, like applying
it
again to
encourage me, made me a little more convinced that maybe I should be an artist. Yeah. Because, I mean, I hadn't been in the Auckland art world, so I'd been in Russell. I was in a small town, so...
Yeah. And then into Ilam your second application? Or?
Yeah. And then I applied to Ilam. But, when I went to I had all these life drawings, like they're all charcoal life drawings, rolled up in a thing when I went to the Wellington Polytechnic. And all these other people had all these really flash folios with fashion drawings. And I went, oh no, I'm never going to get in here. Anyway, I went in and told the woman all about it and how I'd worked in clothing factories in Auckland, which is what I did for a job, and saw all the exploitation of immigrants going on there and thought it was atrocious and got quite political about it while I was there.
Did you mention this in the interview? Did you mention the exploitation?
Yeah. And I just started chatting to her about, because she wanted to know how I got into what I'd been doing for the last year since I left school. So I told her all about that, and she just thought, oh, this is so interesting, because they don't usually get people that go out and work in the industry. And so she said, oh, you can get in. But she saw my drawing. She said, but you should really go to art school, because you could draw, and you should go to art school.
Yeah. Oh.
So I was getting really confused by this point. Okay, so I could get in here, but I should go to art school. Okay.
So did that motivate you to try getting into art again?
It kind of made my mind up, because, okay, I should go to art school. If I get in, I said. So, and then I found out later I got into Ilam. So, yeah, so I ended up going down there and going to art school. Oh, I'll go and try that out. It was always like that. It was like, it wasn't whether I was going to be an artist or not. It was just, I'm going to go and see what it's like to make art all day.
Yeah. Yeah. No pressure.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't put any pressure on myself at all, because I guess I just know myself. I didn't really know. Yeah. I was young. I had no idea what I could do or whether I was any good at it, you know.
and maybe then no great sense, because there's a question I had lined up here about time at Ilam, and I think you've said in the past about how there wasn't a great deal of exposure to New Zealand artistry, let alone female New Zealand painters. Mm. And you know, your practice for the last 20, I think 30 years, at occasion at least, has been noted as a really strong feminist practice. I'm not sure whether you look at the practice like that or not, but at Ilam at the time, no exposure to female painters. So I wondered for you what that was like.
Yeah, well, when I was at Ilam, it was a lot of male tutors. We had one female tutor that came in, and it was Philippa Blair.
Oh, wow.
And she was amazing, because she was full of life, and she was really direct, and she had amazing positive energy. And it was just like, she'd come up and paint on your paintings, and she'd laugh, and she was, and it was so, her style of teaching was so different that it was, you never forgot it. Yeah. And I'm sort of looking back on it, realised that she gave me a lot of encouragement as a woman artist. Like, you could see, oh, you can just go out and be yourself out there and be a woman art. Because at art school, you felt like you had to be something you weren't. Like, you always had to, we had all these crit sessions, and we had to talk about our art, and you weren't allowed to talk about your feelings or anything in those days. But it's all changed. It's all completely changed now.
You must be reflecting, I suppose, a lot on Philippa Blair's influence on you, given that she's only passed away in the last...
Yeah, I know.
Only in the last week.
Yeah, it was very sad to hear that. And, she was a very bright light in it. Yeah, I found her really helpful in that way. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
And other people might not, but I just saw it as a positive female energy, how I saw it.
Which has flowed right through the practice for the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah. And there was another woman there too that was there for a bit too, Bronwyn Taylor as well, and she was in the sculpture department, but I did cross paths with her as well, and she was very encouraging of females artists, students as well.
And I suppose
we had a little bit of short supports, little bits of bursts of females that came in, because we did a little bit of everything in those days. We did a bit of sculpture and painting and photography
but those two really stood out as exceptions.
And Barry Cleveland was there then, and I enjoyed printmaking with him. He was great. And Denise Copeland, she was a female too that was there for a while as well. So there were a few females. I always remember all the females were quite well. I mean, the males too, but you took notice of that because you were a female artist, and you were in a world where females weren't perhaps been seen as good as male artists. So,
Especially at that time, like the mid-80s, right?
I know, it's the 80s, but you think it would be... yeah.
And by the way...
There was still a fight going on then, yeah.
By the way, for listener reference, we're sitting In Seraphin's studio in Rongotai, close to the Wellington Airport. So you might hear in the background, listeners, the occasional plane, which I think you probably just did if you wondered what that rumble was. Well, I suppose speaking of I guess, mainly guys, but you also shared some time at Island with quite an extraordinary lineup of what we now look at as New Zealand painters, or shared that time at Island with some extraordinary New Zealand painters now. So Shane Cotton, Bill Hammond, Tony De La Tour, Peter Robinson, certainly not forgetting Saskia Leake. I wondered if being at Island with all of those remarkably talented painters and including yourself, whether that pushed all of you forward a little more, like you might have been pushing the boundaries or producing work that might have been better as a result, instead of just if you're working in isolation. So,
well, I don't think that, going to art school is necessarily a thing to make a great artist. It's like there's plenty of artists that are self-taught that are great too. So I didn't really see it like that. But when we were there, we didn't really think of ourselves as any great group or anything.
Yeah.
So we were all young and having great... It was just a great social time and, you left home and you're meeting new people and all that was a big part of it. And a lot of those people are still dear friends and we've known each other a long time now. So it's and it's great to see those people go on to do well in the art world as well. And that's just, been really fortunate that we were able to do that. But I think, we all do quite different work, so it's nothing to do with the sort of doing any movement or anything. It was just a time that you just wanted to be there. And I mean, also, it was a lot easier to be at art school then because it was free. Like, we didn't have to pay. It was like we got money to go to school.
Because you were saying it was really...
So we didn't have any pressures outside of that so much, which, going into an art school now, you can see that the anxiety is there and it must make it a lot harder to be free and easy.
Because you've just talked about it being really a bit of an experiment for you.
Yeah, it was a very experimental time. And I think for a lot of us then, because we all came from just regular backgrounds, it's like, Peter came from a farm and Shane came from up here, up in the suburbs of Auckland, in Wellington, and I came from the Bay of Islands. Like, we all came from very different kind of backgrounds as well, which was really good because it was a little bit more like it would have been when my parents went to art school too. So they had people from all different backgrounds come to art school then. So, it was a bit more diverse, I guess, in that way. Yeah, but it's diverse in a different way now, but I just think that it was a little bit more, innocent back then. No internet, no cell phones. It was such a different world. We really had lived in a different world. Yeah. It's hard to tell people that, like tell my son, for instance, what it was like. How did you communicate?
I know, I wonder that myself sometimes.
We have telephones that we dial.
I wonder that myself sometimes, straddled those two periods. Well, leaving Island, and I know this is going to sound like a really broad question, especially because I appreciate it takes time to establish a practice, but it seemed like you wanted to establish a practice that was more about the act of painting than pursuing any specific subject. So broad as that is that right? You were really just wanting to look at painting as opposed to subject matter?
Subject matter comes through me making it. It's like I'm going to do work. I'm thinking of doing some more figurative work, like just the body in it, involved in it. And, subject matter. That's the hardest thing when you, as a painter, what to paint. That's the thing. What to paint. And making art is just like you're creating a problem to solve. So, you have to set that up and then you go into it. And then it's like going on a journey with this thing and finding something in it. It's really hard for me to... I'm not... Well, it changes for me every time. Like, every show I do is, like, quite different to the last.
Yeah.
But,
I approach that in a slightly...
I just go into something that I find interesting, and then that will be, like, I don't know, what have I done before? I did a series on human behaviour and VR. So, and things like that. I'm quite interested in... I'm always, you know, as humans, we're going through life and everything's changing around you all the time. And so you just absorb and pick up these things. And I think I've always been interested in how technology and making and the human hand and making and how we get influenced by that or how that is affecting
us. I guess one of the more interesting aspects of your practice, I think, is that you hinted at this before, but you straddle these two periods of pre-digital and post-digital.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, your practice almost sits 20 years either side.
Yeah.
So that does sound like something you've been really interested in terms of human response.
Yeah, it's just something that's in my mind as I'm going along. But painting seems so... Sometimes you're putting paint on a canvas and you're thinking, what's the point of this making paintings? It's like, because it feels kind of restrained and within the square in the frame. And so, I mean, my last show, I mean, I've been doing things like putting a painting on a painting and doing things really sort of intuitively and temporarily and just putting things together. And I think it's just because I've accumulated so much stuff, rolls of canvas and old paintings everywhere. And you start having a conversation with them and they become the world and you're putting all those things together and they make new things. And yeah, it's all visual, but there's an emotional aspect to it. There's the hand and the mark making and there's the figurative thing, how you look at it, how you feel it. So it's all very much about how I feel it, really. Sometimes I feel like I'm just like in the paint and I'm moving it around with my body and my hands. And I want to really push that a bit further and get more into that.
So at least I guess the approach to painting is equal with any subject matter.
Yeah, it's just materiality. I think the materiality creates the image for me. It's like, I'll throw the paint on and I'm just putting these little marks on that, but that will become something. I kind of find things within it. Yeah.
For listener reference, we're, as I said before, sitting in Seraphine's studio and looking at these new works. I'm looking at one work that has an egg carton that looks like it has been you've been mixing paint in. And then another work sitting immediately to its right, which is a canvas on top of canvas, which is something I've seen a bit in the last few years. They're almost becoming sculptures. So are you folding a little more sculpture into work?
I think that's what it is. It's making a painting into an object. It's a thing, because it is a thing to me.
You want them to be more than two-dimensional.
I lift them up and I move them around everywhere. They're a very physical thing. So I just want to, use it in that way. So, and making paint, it's all about physicality. It's about using my body. My body makes these things. It's not just my head. My head reacts to what my body does, and I think that's how it works.
For listener reference, there's a work that I'll include on the Good Oil Instagram Seraphine Pick post, I think called Bell or Bells, which was in an Australian show you had a couple of tubes of paint in the work. So you seem to be playing with that sculptural element a lot more.
I'm starting to, it's just like the, look, I have all these scraps around my studio. And you just end up with years and years of all these, but they're things. What I do, they're visual things and they're physical things, and I can just stick that on a canvas and it looks like some body part. It looks like a dress.
Yeah.
It's like, and I'm finding that that's kind of an interesting approach, and I'm just starting to go into that physical thing. And I think it's because I started working with clay a few years ago with a friend, Jamie Jenkins, and I started to collaborate with her, and putting my hand in clay just felt so natural to me because I grew up with my father was a potter.
Yeah.
But I'd never really got into pottery at home, like, because my father was just making stuff. But we had, because I grew up by, I had with foster children. My parents fostered a whole lot of children from the state wards and from the Anglican Trust. And so it was a big household, yeah. So it wasn't just me and my, I've got a younger brother, birth brother, but I have all these foster brothers and sisters as well. My dad was always teaching everyone to make ceramics, keep everyone busy. But I kind of, I guess because it was so busy that me and my brother maybe got put to the, to one side a bit because our needs maybe weren't as much as these other children. So I'm not worried about it. I didn't even notice it really. It was some other people noticed maybe. Notice.
Well, it's funny that that has maybe led you back to that collaboration with Jamie Jenkins.
And so then I collaborated with, and it was through Driving Creek. And my father had been to Driving Creek when I was a kid too and worked with Barry Brickell, and he went there with a
guy. And the called, Coromandel, right?
Yeah, the Coromandel. And he went there with a guy called Herbie Kingy. And that was in the, and this would have been right in the 70s. It was when Barry was setting up this place here, building the trains and everything in there, and Herbie Kingy had worked for a brick company, like where they make bricks. And my father told me this, and he helped Barry how to build the kilns because he'd built all the kilns in these factories. So, yeah, and that's how that began. And I didn't, yeah, my dad was there with them, so that was really, yeah, a nice connection to the place. So,
and that worked now with Jamie.
Yeah.
How is that, and we've just talked, I suppose, about the work becoming more sculptural. Is that how that collaboration is helping the practice or helping inform the practice?
Yeah, I'd say that Jamie's watching her make has made me want to be more into the physical making, you know, just slightly more three-dimensional. I haven't gone full sculpture yet. But, I mean, I have made sculpture before. I had a show with Judith Gifford in that early 90s, and I had some sculptural work in there. And that was mainly around the influence of being around sculptors, like Peter Robinson's sculptor. So I knew all the people from the sculpture department. So, yeah, it was all just art. It's all just art to me. Yeah. So I just want to make art. It's not really being a painter. I mean, I primarily made painting because that just ended up what I was, made my living out of, really, as well. So I ended up having to do more painting shows. So, yeah, because you have to have time. You're going to do, be multidisciplinary. You need time to go in deep with each thing. And there's, life's short, like I'm already.
Well, it sounds like, though, you're getting, this is probably the accumulation of wisdom.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're able to apply a lot more intuition to the
and
work.
And it's just
now
applying intuition to it and not so much about, technical knowledge or anything like that.
And is that also why, because it feels like in your practice, especially as we sit here looking at what frankly looks like spectacular new work, the work over the last, I don't know, 5, maybe even 10 years is steadily getting looser and looks as abstract as it does figurative.
Yeah, I've worked with some more abstract, going more abstract with it. Well, going more abstract. Painting's all abstract to me. I mean, you're just making marks on that. It's all abstract. When you look at things, I look out there and I see the tree and I just see all the abstraction, and you just see that. It's just what the eye sees, because we can't see everything. So you just see the energy of it. So that's sort of what I was thinking about when I start to work with more in a more direct, abstract way. Yeah.
So as a reference for listeners, and include an image of this as well, because a favourite work of mine from the last few years has been forest bathing. So which you showed at Michael
like
Lett. So it sounds like you're almost talking about that work in many ways.
Yeah. So it was during the lockdown. I had a show organised at Dane Mossman's gallery here in Wellington when she had it. Then we went into lockdown and I couldn't go to my studio because there were essential workers down there doing the roads and stuff, so I wasn't allowed to go to my studio. So the first time I've been locked out of my studio, that was a bit of it was a very anxious time. Of course.
And as an aside,
anxiety on top of like, oh, my show, how am I going to get my show done? Is it going to happen? What's going to happen? There was just all unknowns. And so I just sat at the kitchen table and did a lot of works on paper, just doing figures and just random things and people with things over their faces, like obscured things, yeah. So it was all this unknown thing. And then I just started doing some little abstract things as well. And I tried to do what everyone else was doing still life paintings, but it really didn't do it for me because it was too much worry going on and anxieties and, yeah, just an atmosphere of it.
Well, we were talking before about how you sense, before we started recording actually, about how you tend to follow your own process before you decide necessarily what a subject of a work is.
Yeah, yeah. So the subject just comes to me. It's just like, it's an experiential thing. It's like, yeah, it might be an image or just a sensation of seeing something or feeling something. I don't know. It's just, it's very hard to, it's not concrete. Yeah. And I find painting, I don't want to make illustrations, so that's not what painting is to me. I've done work that sort of veers towards that, like when I did more surrealist sort of things, and it just didn't sustain me, and I wanted to just let the paint speak a little bit more too. So I feel like I've still got a long way to go with that. That's part of the journey, yeah, I've got to, yeah.
Well,
I think a lot of artists go into that when they get older too. It's like this urgency for time, I think. I think that's really what brings it on. It's like, oh, I need to do this faster. I can't be spending all day doing a little corner. I could never be a realist painter. I admire them, but I could never do it. Yeah.
Well, that brings me back to how much your practice has really changed over, almost 40 years, where, started with it being quite fine figurative detail and then, has steadily loosened up. So I
did real loose paintings when I was at art school, because it was a more expressionistic sort of approach then. I just found that it's probably more a natural approach to me. I tried other things, but
right.
I come back to what I feel like I'm actually better at. Yeah, so I've gone back to it. And I think you do that over your career, go back to things. I'm starting to go back to doing some white sort of paintings with drawings and sort of indelible marks and scratching and all that in them, because I did that right at the start. My first lot of work was all sort of, but it had a subject matter, I guess, a vague one, but it was looking at the idea of memory and memory being erasable, never quite clear, changing. And so that those concepts are still, I think all the concepts still are underlying in my work, but I just change the way I approach them. But they're always there, and it's so like I've got some sort of hand in there. That's me, yeah. It's always trying to find out who you are and what you are, and being true to yourself. And it's really, it takes a lifetime to just really work that out.
So even though it's taking a lifetime, there's some real fundamentals or framework that underpin the whole practice.
Yeah.
Even though your visual language has changed quite a lot in 40 years.
Yeah, and I see my visual language just continually changing because.
Yeah.
You just want to, a visual language is something, it's an experience. So I just want to experience as much of it as I can.
And that's why it seems like, this is going to sound like a really banal question, but why so much diversity? And that's why you want to experience as much as you can.
It's about experience. Yeah, it's about keeping it interesting so I don't get bored. It's kind of works against the commercial art world a little bit in that way, because I can't repeat myself over and over. I just can't do it. I tried. I just feel I don't make my best paintings if I try to repeat it over and over. I just can't do it. It's just because I'm not in it. So I need to be in it. I need to be feeling like I'm learning something new.
And you still are then from the practice.
Yeah, I just want to keep learning. And I think that's a wonderful thing about making art, is that you are always learning something else. in some other way of doing it, or seeing something else in a different way. And I just find it as a totally explorative kind of thing. So, art making is just explorative. I work in a more explorative way in that way. Yeah. And I've worked in other mediums now, so I think that's why I started to do that. Working with Jamie with ceramics, painting on ceramics is completely different to painting on canvas. So you've got to work in a whole different way, and it's great because it challenges you at the same time, and I like to be challenged too. I don't want to know how to do something every time I go and make it. It's like, I don't want to know how to do it because then I don't know what it's going to come out like, and I quite like the fact that I don't know what that painting's going to look like or what that ceramic's going to look like. And ceramics is like that because you can't control it either. So it could blow up in the kiln. And I love that about the ceramicists, that they just like go, oh, it might break. And they're just so ho-hum about it. They don't get devastated or anything. You know, if my painting doesn't work, I used to get so mad if it didn't work out. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just make another one.
So it sounds like that collaboration
it's
kind of,
it was really not really lovely. Yeah.
So it sounds like that collaboration with Jamie is really bringing a fresh approach to the practice in lots of ways. Like
Yeah. And just reconnecting me with ceramics because I grew up around it. So I've got a kind of muscle memory for it. And so I understand it quite fast, and like I guess, oh right, we do it like this, we paint it, like, we'll do it like this, it'll work better. And I'm just learning it, but it's like I can think ahead of it as well about what I want to do with it next and things like that. So, and just because it's a medium I've lived around, so and I've lived around potters, and the way they work is very different to how painters work. And then I did this other work. Collaborative work I did with Andrew Beck as well. He's a photographer.
I'm a photographer, yeah.
And we did a show at the City Art Gallery. Yeah, and so I worked with Photographic Chemicals and did works on paper with that. It's called Chemigrams. And that was really exciting because I had no idea what I was doing, and Andrew was experimenting with it too. So we just let it do what it does, and there were some really cool things that we got. So it was all... That was all completely exploratory and experimental, that show, and it really just set a foundation for what we could do. Yeah, we didn't get that as far because you need a lot of time to be able to keep going with it. So it feeds back into my own work. It just makes me see an approach to using like watercolour or paint or anything else.
Well,
any
or
other
smoke.
Medium.
Like two of a couple of favourite works from your show at Te Uru were works with smoke.
Yeah.
In fact, I noticed in the studio before looking at these charred pieces of wood, I'm wondering if they're the source material.
Oh, yeah, I'm collecting charred pieces of wood at the moment.
to what end, you don't know?
I don't know. So I quite often pick, it's just like we got a beach. I go down to the beach and I find things on the beach. I'm always bringing them back to the studio. I don't know what, but like what rocks and all things around. But they're visual stimulation too. So you collect things for that reason, and I think that's quite common for a lot of artists. And they just sit there. I wonder what I'll do with that. But yeah, I'm getting closer to sculpture.
Well, we talked earlier, again, before we started recording, you were talking about works sometimes taking 20, 30 years to finish. So I guess this is maybe the start of a work you don't really
but
understand.
It's like a process of, like, creating and destroying, really. Like, so you get a canvas. I've got all these painted bits. I just paint on them, really. They'll destroy those. And I'm going to rework on them. It's just like your surfaces. Yeah, they're all surfaces. They're made up over time, and I quite like that aspect of it. They're made over time.
Because as we're sitting in your studio, there's we're surrounded by, I can't count how many, worker on stretcher bars. There's, three, four dozen maybe. Some of this work we're looking at has been in the studio for years and years and years.
I've just carried them around, for years.
And they sit around as reference material or may turn into work.
Yeah. And they just sit around until they, I don't know, you just go up and you decide to do something to finish them. It's like a focus thing. It's like,
yeah.
okay, what can I do with you? Finish you. And then it either works or it doesn't, so you move on to another one. And yeah, they just sit around till you decide. It's kind of they decide, really. The painting decides when it's finished. I don't really decide. Yeah. It's just like I'm doing the action on it, but it takes time for me to see that it's working or not. Yeah, I don't know. It's just a very instinctive thing. Yeah. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
I wanted to come back to people as subjects. Mm. And there's a few guests of the podcast who have said that, you know, painting people, they really have to know them as portrait subjects. So I think Graham Sidney, Michael Smither have said really important that they know the subject. Mm. Looking at your practice, especially when you've painted people,
yeah,
it almost seems the opposite, that it's easier for you if you don't know them, that you want to, I don't know, as it projects them.
Yeah, I've actually been thinking about portraiture this year and thinking, oh, I should really paint some paintings of my family and stuff. So that's what artists do, isn't it? They do some paintings of their...
That's what painters are supposed to do, paint portraits every now and again.
Yeah. Maybe I should do a self-portrait, I don't know. But I mean, I've done portraiture before and I did... I did a series called Looking Like Someone Else in 1997. And that was just... Yeah, it was just... I found images, some made up. I do a combination of things. Sometimes I need a bit of structure, so I'll find an image and just use that as a structure starting point. And some of them were magazine images and stuff, and that whole idea of media making you look like someone else. And then I had this experience where I got... The Moore magazine came and photographed me when I was doing the Rita Angus residency here in Wellington. They got me they put a makeup artist, put all this makeup on me, and I had to wear my Zambezi clothes while I painted it. I said, I kept going, I don't paint in my Zambezi clothes. Why would I paint in
that? You know?
So it was very unrealistic and trying to glamorize the artist. And I thought, well, I hadn't seen that being done to any of my male counterparts, so I thought it was a very female, it was like because I was a female artist. And yeah, it sort of glamorized, it was pretty over the top. And
this was probably in the 90s,
I'm guessing. Yeah, it was in the 90s, and there was a lot of articles coming out of America with artists lying down the floor in front of their paintings and things like that. And they were, it came from the very early thing with Jackson Pollock doing the magazine shoot, and that was where it all sort of started over there in that way, that presenting artists in this glamour way. And yeah, they were trying to do that. I don't know. I got some nice photos of myself when I was 30.
But it seems that you're far more interested in other people than you are yourself in Zambezi and makeup.
And so I did these paint pictures, but then I was more interested in other people, or just in the face and in general as a emotive thing, and not so much in... I think when I do portraits, sometimes I get a bit too fixated on the details, and I find it takes too long.
Well, I
overwork it. You can get in that way if you get a little bit too perfectionist with it, Yeah, trying to capture a personality is another thing, but I haven't really explored that so much. It's more of a universal psychological aspect that I do that just surrounds it.
So are you more maybe anthropologist than portrait painter?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty anthropologist with everything.
Yeah.
And I just like, it's like I'm doing that, and then the finished thing is what, to finish it, it's just... The viewer brings a whole lot of stuff to it. So I really enjoy that aspect too.
Oh, that's interesting. So the anthropology study is both, you know, subject material maybe in the works, but also that aspect of...
The subject too, the viewer, because they bring all their own experiences and they react to that work because of those experiences, and we all have our own... psychology that we bring to work.
Does that leave you surprised at times then by how people respond to work?
Yeah. Sometimes I see things that I hadn't even thought of, and I really like that. It's like, oh, that's interesting, you know. And then you get people that are specialised in things like psychiatrists that come in like, you're not anything like I thought you were because of your paintings, because they're psychoanalysing them, and so they bring a whole different level to it. And, yeah, so it's interesting. Yeah, and then people just do that thing of where an image reminds them of something. So memory kicks in, and memory can be provoked by an image. Like, it's like a trigger.
So actually, it almost sounds like you're as interested in other people's memories as much as you are own and what you're bringing to
a
work.
I'm interested, in how that works. I've tried to figure out why that is, and I think a lot of it is to do and with faces in particular too, because I grew up so deaf, and so I had to use my other senses to understand things, and so I have to like see a face, and I can lip read a little bit, but it's very subconscious. I haven't learnt to, but then just. I read people. I have to understand what's going on, and often I get that wrong. And it's very humorous because deafness is humorous.
That brings me to a quote of yours, actually, that I really wanted to ask about. Yeah. So this is from a conversation, I think, with Lucinda Bennett in Art Collector magazine in around 2018.
Yeah.
And you'd said, I've always read and sensed painting as sound.
Yeah.
So is that to balance out or manage that hearing impairment that you have?
I think that what happens is your because my ears don't work so well, that when I see things visually, I kind of have to hear them. I don't know, it's hard to explain. I kind of hear them as well. So,
well, maybe it's a good like, couple of...
Because my eyes have compensated for my ears. And I think apparently that's what happens when you lose one sense, another sense can take over. So.
Well, I thought a couple of interesting works to talk about in the context of that, like rebalancing or balancing your senses, would be Superstar and Hole in the Sky. Because both of those works, I look at those and they almost have a huge amount of silence.
As well.
Because they should be so loud. Yeah. And for listener context, the subject matter of those paintings, I'll include those in the Instagram post, they're both from a mosh pit at a concert.
Mosh pits, the loud mosh pit, yeah.
Yeah, so are those two works that are a good example of that, how you hear?
Yeah. And so, you've got a person with a mouth open, and so that an indication visually of a sound, but there's no sound coming out. But because it's a painting.
That's Hole in the Sky we're talking about.
So it's a painting, and it's very black and dark and Goya-esque, I guess. And there is, and I think comes from that experience of Goya painting, because I've seen all the black Goya paintings in the Prado. And and he went deaf as well, so I've always had an allergy to him when my father told me he was deaf and made all those big black paintings when he was going deaf. Yeah, and I thought, that's good. I get that. I could get them because of their... They were noisy, but they were made silent. It's like it's a combination of that... There should be noise, but it's silent. And it's about, like, if there's a lot of noise going on, I mean, I can hear some of it because I'm not completely deaf, but I'm hearing it completely differently to other people, and I have no idea because this isn't my normal. But then I miss out on certain levels of sound, so I've got lots of levels of sound missing now, so... Yeah, I don't, like when music plays, I don't really know what it's completely sounds like. It's like seeing something and part of it missing, yeah. Mm.
So that visual compensation, if we frame it that way, does that then extend to colour choice or tone choices? Like, are you quite cognizant of how that translates into a painting?
Yeah, I don't try to think about it too much, like going, oh, yes, blue has this sound or... But I think that they do, but I don't know exactly why. I mean, I just think there's a quivering with some colours and it's like, yeah, some of them are just like very soft and then some are loud and I don't know. It's just, and it's how you put them together.
Yeah, again, you're feeling your way through those paintings.
Yeah, and as you just, yeah, and it's just me that notices. I mean, it's like my language and no one else. Language is, so it's like, yeah, I don't know whether what other people pick up from that, but they'll pick it up completely differently. And I that's why I don't take it as that you have one opinion of anything, because there's many. The world's, everything is made up of many things and is seen in many different ways. Well, there isn't one answer.
That probably leads to another quote of yours that I wanted to ask you about, which is, most of my work, and to be fair on you, this is from 1999.
Oh, yeah, that's
what I'm talking about. But that quote, most of my work has an ongoing sense of the fragmented, a feeling of overload and lack of control. Now that quote now is some 25 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that still present in the work? For you?
Yeah, I think it's always like that. It's just like when I start a paint, it's like a mirage. And it's like I can see a little bit of what it is or what it's going to be. And I just need to keep going until I find it. I can have a painting in my head and think I'm going to make that painting, but it never comes out how it is in your head.
So are you unpacking?
Because your head changes what it sees, changes it all the time because... Our brains are just stimulated by so many things, and you're never going to hold that thought.
So are you trying to unpack that overload in your own brain onto the support?
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's an impossibility, isn't it? I don't know. It's like...
But it's certainly still true.
It is like that. I mean, I think you can think about your making. You can make a painting in your head, like you're always doing. I've talked to other painters, like making the painting in your head at night in the middle of the night. Oh, yeah, I'm going to do it like this. and it's like this overload in your brain. And so it's kind of what drives you to go and make, because you have to. You have to get it out somewhere. You've got to pick up a brush and put some paint on something, get it out.
Again, managing overload.
To get that action to manage the overwhelm, I guess it is. It becomes overwhelm, because you've got too many ideas in it, too many. You're never going to have... And as you get older, that gets even worse because you've got less time. I can't do all of those ideas in my lifetime, It's like that. It's like the sense of, you start to get a sense of urgency. So it's like, I've got all these ideas I want to experience, And so it becomes becomes right in the forefront. Yeah.
So does that mean your process is almost speeding up in a way of you laying down, more and more ideas? Like, again, as we sit in the studio, there's so much work.
Like that,
right.
I end up with, I've got so much more to do. And I think that you have to try and, break that down. And it's like, you're trying to break it down. And because we work from show to show to show to show, it's like I don't get 2 or 3 years off just to play around with it and work that out. It's like you've got to produce something, then put it out there. It's just that's the structure I work within. So, I kind of, that's the battle, I think, is that battle of having to make things not so much in your own, at your own pace in a way. You kind of...
Although we were talking about
and then you want to speed that pace up, but Yeah, it's really weird. It's a weird time, yeah, in that way, yeah. And also I've got to the point where I've worked really hard and I've got there and now I've got my own studio and I've got the means to do it. Yeah, so...
But you are slowing down a little bit. You were talking about...
I should be doing all sorts of things now, you know.
But you were talking about slowing down a little bit in terms of just two shows this
Physically,
year.
Physically, you have to. Yeah. You kind of get more conscious of that too, yeah. You've got to slow down a bit.
Yeah.
Although, you know, you get inspired when you see artists in their 80s just doing the thing, you know, making art still. And you really want to be able to get there, but you've got to pace yourself to get there. And you can't just go full tack.
Well, it's funny, you're closing in on 40 years of painting.
Mm.
And the way you're talking about it today, you really sound like you've just started yesterday in a sense.
Yeah,
like in terms of how
and
much
I
you
like
want to explore.
The fact that it's fresh. It's still be fresh.
And it is fresh every time you come into the studio.
Yeah, it is. It feels like that every time I come in. I go, where was I at? Where was it? And then I wander around and get distracted by my own art and go, oh, I need to do something on this one. And then, oh, no, I'm supposed to be working on those ones. Yeah. So I have to turn them against the wall. That's for how you do it, how you deal with it.
Well, it looks like...
Because your brain just automatically starts working on a work as soon as you look at it. Yeah.
Because as we sit in the studio, I can see at least... what appear to be half a dozen works on the go. So you will work on multiple works at once.
I work it all on at once, yeah. It's partly practical because you want different drying times for the paint, for different technical ways of working. So you can do the wet on wet, you can do the layered, and yeah, they all have different drying times. You've got different mediums to make them dry at different levels. And so... yeah, there's partly that, and also because it's very easy to just overwork a painting. It's like put too much on it, or I don't know. It's just an aesthetic that you develop about surface. Yeah, yeah.
And is that also a reflection of how much how much material you will vary on different paintings? Because, you know, some paintings appear to have a lot of layers, others...
Well, you can put a lot on at once, you know. Like just squeeze all the tubes out and put it on. And like all those technical things I'd like to try with my work as well. So, and I just seem to have a curiosity with materials and what you can do with them. Like I've done, I mean, not just with oil paint, like I've been working, making casein paint as well with milk. And it's milk paint. It's a very old medium.
Wow.
And you can make, that one over there, I've just started with casein. That's casein too. So it looks like acrylic. It's got a beautiful sort of feel. It sinks into the canvas.
Well, it looks very soft.
It's like watercolour. So
yeah.
And because I do a lot of works on paper with watercolour and gouache, and I love doing those, and I'm really quick and fast at doing those, and they just happen, and I'm trying to translate that into my painting at the moment, trying to get to that. Yeah, and so there's a lot of that goes on, exchange between drawing your works on paper and your paintings too. It's not so much you do a picture and then you make a painting of it, it's you do a lot of pictures and you get a sense of some sort of action or some sort of way of working that you can try and translate onto canvas.
So is that a process for you where you will experiment quite a bit on other supports before you move
a
work, even if it's not
I
literal?
I kind of work on both at once, actually. I just, like, go between, Like, I get to a point on the canvas and I think I need to go and do another drawing to work out the next step of it, to see where it's going, to create a path of where it's going.
So that all happens in parallel, not chronologically of a work on paper and then into...
I'm all over the... It's all just what I feel like. It's all driven by... I feel like doing that right now. I feel like working on that painting. I feel like doing working on that one. It's not like I... That's why I find it's quite hard doing shows, because I have a limited amount of work I can... I have to do for the show, and I have to, those all have to work. So I have to do a lot of paintings to make those five or six paintings worked. So I can't just do work on five canvases and that's going to be the show, because it won't be. I will take risks and they won't work.
Yes. And you mean you'll create a lot of work to pull out a few specific paintings, let's say half a dozen paintings, that look like a specific show.
Yeah. I always have a whole lot of, I guess sort of... leftovers, like all the dead paintings.
Yeah, that don't make it into a show.
And so they become all these leftovers that it's like the tide going in and out. And so that's why I end up with years and years of some paintings taking that long to make. Yeah. Because they just become the leftovers that I just rework, reuse. Yeah. By doing that, then I work out, I guess... Yeah, get the right momentum to do it directly on a fresh canvas, because that's the ideal. If you can do it quickly, fresh on a fresh canvas, you get a whole different feel. That's the thing you want trying to do all the time. Well, it's trying to get that fresh.
Yeah, because that's something that, especially in the last decade, where the work has become looser and maybe more abstract, it feels so immediate, so much of it. So that's something you're really striving for as well.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. It's like doing something in an immediacy, and it takes a lot of confidence, and I think that's what I have to always try and draw out of myself, because I feel I am probably a little too critical and hard on myself in that way. Like, I kind of... not really sure if it's good or not sometimes, and it's just a weird insecurity thing that develops sometimes. It's old stuff, probably just carrying old baggage. carry with you. We all have a little bit of that, and it's just like, and it is something that, you're aware of. Yeah.
So if someone walks into a Seraphim Pic show and is looking at a dozen paintings, they're actually looking at 36 or 48 paintings that contribute to that show eventually.
Yeah. It takes a lot. And even though there is that self-doubt that comes in, and you have to battle with that, somehow that little bit of anxiety, that human aspect, comes through in the work, and I think that's interesting when you see that in paintings or in art.
We're back to your anthropology.
Our humanity just holds in there, and I think that's the most interesting thing. And I think there's going to be a need for more, to see more of that vulnerability and those things with the advent of all the AI and the technology that is all becoming part of our reality. It's like the virtual and the real are overlapping. And so, yeah.
Painting's not dead yet.
And painting is like this primal thing, you know? I mean, like Casper, when he was...
Your grandson.
Grandson. He came and did some painting. You see a child, like all they're doing is experiencing the paint. It's all experiential. It's like, rub it over here. There's no cognitive thinking about where we're going to put this colour or that colour. Yeah, no subject. It's just, it is the moment. They're in the moment. They're in that. And there's something beautiful about that. And that's the thing that I think that you're always trying to go back to, is trying to get that as feeling back into the work, and that kind of experience back into it. I do some finger painting as well. So there'll be a lot of scrubbing around and moving paint around a little bit more.
Nice.
Without the brush as well.
I think last question. Removing any limit of budget or even whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist work in general would you love to live with?
Well, there's lots. Like, there's Frances Hodgkins, of course, and Marlene Dumas, her figurative works. I went to Oslo last year and saw the Munch Museum, and just seeing a whole museum full of one artist's work it's just amazing to see a whole lifetime of one artist's work, just to see how that looks. It's like, it's pretty amazing to see. Yeah, it makes you want to paint when you're doing that. You're just going, oh, I want to go to the studio and make some paintings now. And that's like a great thing to, if you see an artwork and it makes you want to go and paint, you know it's good work. It's funny, it's a funny question, because if you answer it, it's like you're saying something about yourself. And so it's quite a personal question.
Is it the most personal question I've asked?
Yeah, it's the most personal question you can ask anyone. I've got a very big art library. That's how I live with the art that I like. But and that changes all the time. From one year to the next, I'm into a different artist. Like, I love Robert Rauschenberg and Cy Twombly and Gauguin and, I like all that and them as well. And it's like, there's so many, you know. But if it was to do with an art meaningfully of what you, like, I suppose it would be like a Goya, because that's where the fire began.
As always, thank you for listening. Your next chance to see new work from Seraphine will be from the 23rd of July at Michael Lett Gallery in Auckland, Tamaki Makaurau, and then from the 29th of November at Station Gallery in Naarm, Melbourne. Please join me for episode 31 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.